Welcome to Farming Aotearoa with agricultural journalist Peter Burke. Hello folks and welcome back to another episode of Farming Aotearoa, sponsored by Rural News, the newspaper that gets the top stories to farmers every week. And this month there are lots of top stories, and to tell us all about these in the studio I have with me agricultural journalist Peter Burke, who works for Rural News. Hello, Peter.
Hello, Catherine. How are you?
Well, I'm very well, thanks. You're looking very fresh after being out on the golf course today.
Yes, I feel good. I've had a good day sort of being out there enjoying myself. I had a great day just getting out in the fresh air. It's been the weather forecasters were wrong, which is wonderful. I hope they'll do that more often. So it was supposed to be wet and it's been fine all day. And it's great fun. I enjoy just getting out and getting some fresh air. So, yeah, a lot of big stories around. And just to recap, you know, last time we talked, we were talking about the fact that Massey University were going to run some special courses to train teachers to teach agricultural subjects. Well, that was a great story. Everyone's happy. Mm. Wonderful. But then the good old Ministry for Education walks into the room and says, "Oh no, we don't want those. We're going to cut those out." Well, you know, I have to say that would be one of the dumbest decisions that's happened in 60 years in New Zealand agriculture.
It's pretty silly.
It was pretty stupid. And despite the fact that there were students wanting to do these courses, and yet the ministry said, "Oh no, we'll just get them to do vocational work," which really means it teaches them to pick fruit and to do menial tasks. Here are these kids who want to become scientists, they want to become agricultural scientists, they want to go to the top, and the ministry was saying, "No, just dumb it down, that's fine." You know, and it annoyed me a lot, and annoyed a lot of other people who see the view beyond Johnsonville, that's a little suburb just out of Wellington, who think that agriculture is for dummies only, and it's not. It's actually for those, it's the best, brightest, and the, you know, and they can do wonderful things, earn wonderful money, have exciting careers. Anyway, there was an outrage, and understandably so. And the teachers got onto the minister. Everyone else did. We got onto them as well. And over the weekend, suddenly the ministry decided, "Oh, we might have made a mistake. Oh, this is really important, is it?" So, you know,
part of feeding our nation and other nations is not important.
Well, I just can't understand it. It breaks my heart sometimes that some of the stuff that comes out of Wellington, and I know that a particular party wants to get the farming out of Wellington. Well, they've got a point, actually, and that was a classic point of one where even the Prime Minister, I think, weighed in and said this is pretty stupid on their part. So the poor old minister had to come back 2 days later and say, "Oh, no, it's actually wrong. We're going to do it. We're going to reinstate those things," which they did to their credit. And I guess the minister, in that sense, at least understood what the problem was and quickly got onto it. And
that's good, yeah.
But it showed again what I would call people power, because there was it came from all directions. It came from industry itself. It came from the universities. It came from the teachers. It came from students as well, all saying, "What the hell?" You know. So we've got over it now, and I think everyone's going to work together. And I think what it has done, at least probably, even though it wasn't it was a bit of a rough ride. I suspect now that the ministry is going to take a little bit more notice of what happens beyond the outer suburbs of Wellington, because Wellington doesn't earn much in terms of you can't graze many cows down Manor Street or in Midland Park as it was. So I don't know. I think that's the good news, is that hopefully they will now start to realise they've got to look at and talk to people in agriculture to actually see what careers are. And I think the other thing that the ministry should be doing is also getting out there and talking to parents, because parents influence young people's careers. Now, I don't know, mine never influenced mine. I was just so bloody minded that I didn't need anyone to tell me what to do. I just did it. But I do think that sometimes parents do have a say in that. And maybe there's got to be an education program, not just for students to look at the opportunities in agriculture and science around it, but maybe parents have got to look at that one too. So that I think was a pretty big story. And for me, one that's occupied a lot of my time and a lot of interest, and it's been fun to write about.
I bet.
So, you know, I quite enjoy having a go at these things. I mean, I'm not beyond having a bit of a fight if I can help it, you know, but not a nasty one, just a bit of a strategic tantrum, you might say.
Yeah. Now, we've spoken about this next one before, if we're happy to move on to the next topic.
Yeah.
Is the implications of planting pine trees for carbon credits. This one gets up my nose quite considerably.
It does, and it's not a good one. And what we're seeing now is that an interesting comment from a guy called Bruce Wills, who has been a former president of Federated Farmers and a person I hold in very, very high regard. I think he was one of the best presidents that's ever been in Federated Farmers. He had a farm called, I think it was Trenolo, up in Hawke's Bay, and that farm was surrounded virtually by forests. And he pointed out to me that, you know, one of the challenges for him was that the pests, the deer, the pigs, everything sort of came into his place. The pine trees fell over. They broke his fences. Mm. Guess what happened? The deer sort of came in and ate the pasture. And the cost of that was quite heavy. He said the problem you found was that the people who run the forests come in, they plant and leave. They don't really stay around too long. They come in, put the trees in, come back and look at them, but they're not there all the time. And he said, you know, the issue for me was that they were not neighbours. If a fence went down, I had to fix it. If the deer got through, I had to get them back off the property. What this leads to is the fact that we are now getting more carbon farms being set up. And I look around when I drive through the countryside, and I drive quite a lot around the North Island, and I see beautiful, beautiful, good land being used for flipping pine trees, to put it crudely.
I mean, it drives me mad that you're potting up a pine tree because they're just going to come down again.
Well, they are, and it's a bit like, and this probably won't get up the noses of some people, but, you know, schools that plant trees, eventually they've got to be cut down because they're a nuisance. That's the problem with trees. They're a lovely idea, but they're there for a time. But
if they're in the right place, we should be concentrating on planting native forests.
They should be. And I think this is just, this carbon idea has really got away, it's got away stupidly in my view. And hence this very, very strong warning from people like Bruce Wills, who've experienced that, knows what it's like, and is now saying to farmers, if you're going to find that your neighbour is now going to be a carbon farmer, be prepared to understand they probably live somewhere
in another country.
Mm. They don't come here at all. The person they appoint just does what they're told by them anyway. And there is no redress for them if things go wrong.
Mm.
And we're already getting a situation now where our deer numbers in the wild are increasing massively. They're coming up. All we're doing with these is providing more habitat for them, probably. Pigs are the same. And the interesting thing is that someone said to me the other day, well, we can get the deer numbers down, but then the pig numbers will come up because it's a matter of, it's really trying to get that balance. Now, the old days when we had Barry Crump, who used to be a deer culler and go out and, you know, with his belly and his 5 days of food and I won't say what else, but anyway, and kill deer. But nowadays that doesn't happen too much. And the deer populations are a problem. They're encroaching on good farmland. They're eating pasture, which has cost money to put down. They're breaking down fences, which cost money to put up. They're giving habitat to possums, which cause bovine tuberculosis, which is a big problem. It's always been a problem on the West Coast. That's where it is one of the biggest areas, because you've got a lot of those farms back onto large tracts of dockland, native bush, possums there, obviously. But I think there's a real warning in this one, and the amount of land being lost is huge. But the other thing which I think is really important is that with farms, you bring people into a community. You have a village there. It has shops. It has all these things. You have people around it. There's community. There are schools. But when that area becomes the base for a big forestry operation, there's no people there. I mean, forestry does not employ people full-time. They're gangs that come in and out. So therefore, we're destroying our rural communities by doing this. And I think this is a very stupid decision on the part of government to allow it to the extent they've got it now. They might not like me for saying that, but I don't really care. I think they're saying they're putting restrictions on it. Well, yeah, but yeah, right, I suppose is the answer. And I know that Beef and Lamb, the organisation that represents sheep and beef farmers, is very critical of government for what they're doing in this area. The party is supposed to be farmers free, and I'm not so sure that many farmers actually think that. They think it in a lot of other ways, but in this area they don't think they're very friendly at all. They'd like to see harder rules placed around it. And I think they've actually got a really good point. You know, it's that threatening of communities. In Europe, for example, you don't get this. There's a deliberate attempt in Europe to try and keep rural communities going.
Yeah.
Now, I don't know. I suppose I've got a silly saying, but, you know, once upon a time, it was called New Zealand, you know, EWE Zealand. Now I think it's going to be called New Treeland. Now, that, but because that's a very, there's a lot in that. It's, we're just seeing things happen now that, that make me, oh my God, why? You know, can't these people read a history book?
Well, there's that as well as the damage that is caused once they slash all these trees down.
It is, and you get to that stage of you know, of saying the slash problem on Tairāwhiti is massive, and the forest owners, some of them are pushing back on doing anything about it. Well, I've got a word for that, but I won't use it on air.
But
I think they should clean it up and take responsibility for what they've done. Why should people lose their beaches? Why should people lose their clean rivers? Because someone else has been not doing their job properly or leaving it to nature to cave. And it's wiped out bridges to communities. It's wiped out people's lives.
Yeah.
I think this is wrong.
Yeah.
I'm not a forest person. I think there is a place for forestry, and one has to be careful about saying where it should be. It does things to, if it gets rid of erosion, that's good. We owe a lot of this to Muldoon, the Muldoon era, of course, because back in the 70s, there was a move to try and take native scrub off land to grow pine trees, and that was done. So, dear old Rob, if you're listening up there and, you know, up in the little in the clouds, a lot of people don't think you did a great job.
Okay, well, you can't talk to them now, so let's move on to the next one, which is celebrating the dairy industry at Parliament.
Yeah, it's. I was very fortunate to be invited to a breakfast, which was nice. Actually, I went to a thing in the evening the night before, and I'll talk about that later. But this was about the Dairy NZ, who represents dairy farmers, and the Dairy Companies Association of New Zealand, which represents dairy producers. So the two organisations had a breakfast. It wasn't bacon and eggs and, you know, and black pudding like I'd expect them an Irish breakfast. But anyway, it was all right. But the aim was to try and get people to understand and just hear and to celebrate that the dairy industry is such a massive earner for New Zealand. Without people complain about dairying, you know, being this and that and the other thing. But all right, darlings, fine, but you can't have an economic. Dairy is the economic powerhouse of New Zealand at the moment. It's the biggest export earner. So I don't see what the problem is. Yes, there can be things improved, and no, we'll talk about that in a minute. But it's important to see that dairying is celebrated in a way. Nicely, we had the Prime Minister there, others, MPs around, people who are also involved in the sector, be they processors, CEOs of some of the dairy companies, and scientists, and even a few of us stragglers called the media along there, which was interesting to be there. But the comment was made that, you know, that they don't want to be the villains. They don't want to be. I think the phrase "dirty dairying" was invented by someone from Fish and Game, I think, for memory. It's not all dirty dairy. I mean, that's, yes, there are times, but there's also dirty cities as well. People forget that when you can't swim at Oriental Bay, there's no cows up in Molesworth Street. There's no cows in Mount Cook, and yet you can't swim at Oriental Bay. That's because of city pollution. Mm. So sometimes there are certain people and individuals who tend to seize upon what's happening in the country where they never go and forget what's, overlook what's happening in their own cities. And too often, how many overflows of sewage do we see from cities into waterways, into swimming areas? Quite a lot, and not too much done about it. So, you know, I'm just a bit annoyed about that stuff. So I sound grumpy. I'm probably older than I'm allowed to be. The chair of Dairy NZ, Tracy Brown, made it quite clear, you know, a lot has happened in the last 15 years, and the Dairy Companies Association is saying the same thing. And that all came down also to an issue which, as I've meant to say it before, but the importance of dairy to keep it going is also the science in it. And talking to the CEO of Dairy NZ, Campbell Parker, he talks about the need to get young people into science so that they can progress the dairy industry, because it's gone, it's amazing what's happened. It's been going since about 1925, for memory of the Dairy Board. So it's almost 100 years, just 100 years it's been going. And that has been, and its growth has been there because of the science. And I think that's important to remember that. So therefore, education, science, dairy, they're all interwoven. And it's great to see young people coming through our universities and our tertiary institutes and making careers in those areas, because they're going to be the people that are going to lead this country in the future and make it and give it the wealth that it requires. But it's going to be the science that's going to do it there. So yeah, and you know, that's sort of getting young people to pitch ideas up, coming up with ideas. I know one school runs a thing called Crocodile Pit. Now that means that students are given the chance to come up with an idea that they think will help the dairy industry or the farming sector, and they pitch it like the dragon.
Oh yeah, the dragon den.
The dragon den, yeah, and they do that, and that's to encourage young people to think at a very early age what the possibilities are. What can they do? How can they think to make them think about things? And they come up with some great ideas apparently. So there's something to take away in the back pocket for the week. Bit fun, eh?
Fantastic. Okay, so now talk to me about trade, and this one gets asked quite a bit actually. Some of the impediments to free trade.
Yeah, everyone talks glowingly about free trade agreements, and they should do, because they're very good. We've had some great free trade agreements, and we've just got, you know, some recently. We've got the UK one, we've got the one with the EU, we've got others in the Gulf States, and we have trade agreements with China and so forth. But what we don't talk about too much is what we call the non-tariff trade barriers. So you can have a free trade agreement, but then you can have other impediments, which are, I would call them largely technical. And they might be, you know, phytosanitary type things. They might be labelling. They could be anything. But they're, do I say, little niggles, if you like, that can be inserted into any free trade agreement by the importing country. And I think New Zealand at the moment is dealing with, I think it's nearly 200 of these, but they're costing the country around $10 million. $10 billion, sorry. So that's the cost of these little mini regulatory things which go on behind the scenes and you don't really hear too much about, because my colleagues in the mainstream media don't talk too much about them because that's technical. They don't see the advantage of the problem with it. But they are things which affect exporters. It might be that a certain country has a certain way of wanting labels. It may want to have certain inspections before they go. It might want to have a certain check at the border. And they can be inserted anywhere along the line. They're technical things. So there's a lot of talk about, you know, what can be done with that. And I think I went along to a function with the meat industry recently, and they were talking about saying, you know, they pay about $600 million or in tariffs already, but the non-tariff trade barriers for them is worth about $1.5 billion. So they're ending up losing $1.5 billion in these little niggly trade things that go on behind the scenes. And interesting to talk to people like MPI. They're the people that deal with it a lot, and probably customs deal with it too, and sometimes MB. While Foreign Affairs does the big things and they get the big overpicture, behind the scenes there are all these little technical things that go on, and it's interesting to hear how they are working through these issues of non-tariff trade barriers. And I know that the Ministry for Foreign Affairs and Trade has set up a special group in its own department to look at that. MPI have always done that. They've been part of it. So we're seeing a lot of money that's being lost. I know that the horticulture sector gets ahead of it too. They're just niggles which we're trying to work through. And that's something that we're, you know, the dairy industry's got the same problem. You know, they're again saying that they're losing a huge amount through these non-tariff trade barriers. And, you know, for them, the same problem exists. They were saying they've identified something like 35 of these which affect their industry alone. So, you know, and it's despite the fact, like New Zealand, for example, New Zealand had a deal with Canada through the Comprehensive Trade for South Pacific, it's a CTPP, which allowed them to export dairy produce to Canada. But the Canadians continued to put on little niggly things which stopped that. And New Zealand won court cases, won battles with the WTO, and it's taken about 3 years suddenly to get the Canadians, who you'd think would be good citizens, to actually agree to the rules of trade. And what we are seeing at the moment is that in the past, New Zealand has lived very much because of what you would call rules-based trading, through the World Trade Organization, which sets parameters, rules around how you will trade, what you can do. But with Trump coming in and others now, they're breaking away from those things. They're saying, well, no, that doesn't apply to us. So it's becoming much harder for people like New Zealand to rely on honesty, if you like, and it's not something that you get them a lot of other countries, to abide by rules. They say, oh, no, not a, it's fine, we just don't agree with that rule. And I find that rather sad in a way, because, you know, the world is starting to, go down because of it. Interestingly enough, I was talking to a very, very, very well-known New Zealand politician, former politician, Sir Lockwood Smith, who has been, maybe you'll know, he's been a Minister of Agriculture, he's been a Minister of Trade, High Commissioner to London. And he was saying that one of the things that he thinks sparked off Trump was the fact that things such as subsidies behind the border, for example, China is a classic example of this, where the government subsidises its manufacturers to make things cheaper. So then they can produce goods cheaper than anyone else, therefore they sell them on the open market, therefore they make others uncompetitive, but it's actually the government who's actually making that. It's not the true profit of it, it's not true honesty about it. And that's an issue which he's saying, well, why doesn't New Zealand work with the United States and see if they can get China and others to come back and maybe break down some of those internal barriers which would allow us and others to abide by the rules, give everyone a fair shot at the game. You know, we're not asking for, we don't subsidise anything, we're free of that. So why can't that happen? And they all have these wonderful names. They're called competitive market distortions.
Okay.
I mean, you just sort of, yeah. you just choke on that. But what they are is simply really subsidies. That's the code word for it. So a lot happening in that trade space, and it's going to be ongoing. I don't think we're going to see, every week there seems to be something new comes up on trade. It never goes away. It's part of life.
Now, you wanted to talk to me as well about unlocking potential at Māori land.
Yeah, interesting. I had a discussion a few weeks back with the Māori trustee and CEO of Te Tūma Paerua, Dr. Charlotte Severn. And one of the issues that's been raised is there was a lot of Māori land which is landlocked. There's no access to it from road. How do you unlock that land? How do you unlock the potential of that land? And she is the one that's saying, you know, there is a real possibility. Why don't we do something about it? There's big money to be gained by it. We know that, for example, MPI said something like over 200,000 hectares of land was classed as vacant. If they could get that land that is inaccessible at the moment and into full production, an extra $400 billion is the prize at the end of the day. It's a lot of money, isn't it? That's what we're getting. So what she's saying is that even Māori themselves are not doing as well as they should be. They're not collaborating in a way they could do. And they're using the idea that you can't join up different trusts to form a bigger company. Now, I know that a couple of trusts that I've been involved with, two or three have come together and built a company. Now, they haven't sold their land or they haven't leased their land, but they've used scale to make gains. And scale is very important, because if you look at some of these smaller entities, they still have to have overheads. So they might have a chief executive, they might have an office and all that sort of thing. If you can bring all that into one and farm on scale and use, better equipment, you're going to save a lot of money, and actually the money will then trickle down to the shareholders, because at the moment, in a lot of some of these smaller trusts, I don't think the shareholders are getting much out of it at all. I remember talking to some guys I used to go out with, knock around with, and they were saying they got very little out of what they belong to. And that's not unsurprising. If there might be 2,000 shareholders, might be more, it could be 10,000. But certainly there is a prize there for that, and she's the one that's saying, okay, Māori need to be more collaborative. They've got to, put their self-interest away, stop the personality stuff, just get on with it and do it. And there is that wonderful prize at the end of it, which is beneficial to Māori. It's also beneficial to the country as well. So that's something that's on our books at the moment. And I think that's something it's nice to see her raise that. She's saying that there was an act called the Te Tūru Whenua Māori Act, And that allows us to happen. It's just simply, there's nothing to stop it happening legally. It's simply the people thing that's stopping it. That's all.
Okay. We haven't got a lot of time left at all, but have we got some time to talk about energy crisis and how it's affecting
tomatoes? Yeah, I think the energy crisis, particularly around tomatoes, is interesting because we've got glass. We get tomatoes here all the year round because they're grown in glasshouses, because they're heated.
Mm.
We use coal, we use gas, we use electricity. And the tomato industry sector is now facing quite a dilemma because the gas supply is running out, the electricity charges are high, you can't get a price on it, and you know they're being told to decarbonise, in other words, not use coal. And it's coming to a point where they don't really know where to turn to. And the risk in all of this is that they might have to, some will give it away. Will we import tomatoes from Australia? Yes, we might do. Will we import vegetables, tomatoes from other parts of the world, as opposed to growing them, you know, around the year round in New Zealand, because we can only grow them through glasshouses. We can't grow them outside. So that's an issue. It's not a... And they are very concerned at what's going on. They've been saying to government, let's give us an energy strategy, give us some time to get this thing sorted through, give us some pricing, and then we can do it. The same actually applies to the meat industry. They've got the same problem. Again, rising energy costs, same issues, and again, it's putting the pressure on productivity, profitability in the meat industry. So the energy crisis is a big one for everyone. It's not just the householders, but it's big for industry. And are these companies going to survive under the present regime? Is government going to step in and maybe make some rules around that? Where's it going to end? I don't know. But certainly we're seeing in the tomato industry particularly that fear that we maybe have to import, and that's not a great thing for New Zealand. We want our own fresh.
Yeah, that's that. I don't think I eat tomatoes in winter. I just always grow my own, so it doesn't affect me.
No, well, I do the same, but you know, I like tomatoes.
So they never taste the same, though. But I know I understand the problem, but yeah.
I get them because they're good, and but yes, you're right. I mean, the homegrown tomato doesn't look great, but it tastes beautiful.
Absolutely, and I must say, I lived in Australia for a long time. Their tomatoes are terrible.
Yeah,
they look good, and yeah. They taste terrible.
Yeah, their
tomatoes here are beautiful.
Yeah, they are. I think so. We get, but they're very expensive down the shops. You would.
Well, yeah, that's why I don't buy them in winter.
I know, I don't blame you. And I would.
And I can understand why they're so expensive, given if they're having to pay this.
Well, the cost of energy is rising.
High energy price, yeah.
And that's just one part of it. I mean, energy costs are about one third, I think, of the cost of production for glasshouses now.
Mm.
So, you know, what do you do with your glasshouse now? Do you grow cucumbers in it? Do you grow other things in it? Maybe yes. Maybe they'll turn away from it. I don't know. But they're certainly going through a period of time now where they're going to say, well, what do we do next sort of thing.
Yeah, we don't want to lose the tomatoes in summer.
We don't.
You know, we don't want to sacrifice
that. I've got mine
in
already.
I've got mine in my own little glass house, which is a plastic bag over a tub of dirt with some seeds in it.
I put mine in pots now. I don't grow them in the garden. I used to grow them in
the garden. No, they're in pots waiting, and then I'll transplant them.
Yeah, I'll just leave mine in pots, I think. And then I can. The reason for that is that they like to get new soil every year, so that's why I do it for pots.
Fair enough, too.
Anyway.
Yeah.
We're not the gardening show, but we can.
No, we're not. But it's still farming. Just little farms.
It's horticulture, absolutely. Yeah, mini farming.
Well, that's about all we've got time for today. We might have to leave the other stories till next time.
That's right. I'll be back next time.
Thanks for coming in.
Great to be here. Always lovely.
This program was made with assistance from New Zealand On Air for radio broadcast and through the accessmedia.org.nz website. Thank you, New Zealand On Air.